In this week's episode, I interviewed horror writer Chad Miller, all the way from the United States of America. Let's jump into his episode now. See you on the other side. Hello and good afternoon to you, Chad. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent.
It's wonderful to finally talk to you. We've been trying to do this interview for quite some time now. So welcome to the Author to Author podcast. Please tell my listeners a little bit about you.
Sure. My name is Chad Miller, and I'm an author, but that's my, you know, side job. I'm a pharmacist by trade. But I've been writing for 25 years, but I haven't published anything until fairly recently. About a year and a half ago was the first thing that I had published, was a short story before going on to the novels. So I've been writing for some time, crafting my skills and honing them and basically doing it for fun. It's a passion of mine. So it's something that I wanted to explore professionally and to put my work out there so other people could see it.
That's wonderful. But if we can go right back to the beginning, where were you born and where do you live now?
Sure. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I spent most of my life there. I consider myself a Philly guy. So even though I don't live there now, I'm always a Philly guy. It's, you know, part of who I am. For a brief time, I moved to New Hampshire for a little bit. It didn't work out. It was nice, but it wasn't for me. So we moved back to Delaware, which is a small state, which is near Philadelphia. And we basically moved back because my family's here. So we want to be close to family. So here I am.
I'm sorry, I can't help myself. But is that West Philadelphia, born and raised, or is it another part?
I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, which is like more, it's not more like the, more suburban than like the inner city. But I did go to school in West Philly. So I do have some West Philly roots. That's where I went to pharmacy school, in Philadelphia College of Pharmacy, which is in West Philly. And I lived for a time in Center City, like the main part of the city, which was, that was my favorite. I'm a city guy. Me and my girlfriend are trying to get back to have some kind of residence in a city. So hopefully, you know, soon, but we have kids and things like that. So it's complicated.
So where are you based now?
In Delaware. So Delaware is a state about like 45 minutes to an hour outside of Philly, kind of in between DC and New York geographically, but it's, you know, or the nearest biggest city is Philly. And we go there often. We probably go there, we try once a week, but a couple times a month.
So why pharmacy school? What happened that led you down that particular route?
Well, I mean, growing up, I was not a good student at all. So I kind of breezed through high school, and undergrad, I went to Syracuse University. And to be honest, I went there just to have fun. But I kind of fell into psychology just because I thought it was interesting. It was the only subject that really interested me. But I didn't do that well. I mean, I mainly partied and, you know, had a good time. So I graduated. I did graduate. I got a BA in psychology. But, you know, I had a mediocre GPA. It wasn't a passion of mine. So I didn't really pursue psychology. So I worked for a year. And, you know, it wasn't a job that was going to get me anywhere. So I knew I needed a career path. I was writing wise. I just started writing at that point. So that wasn't a career path yet. You know, I have a medical background. My sister's a doctor. My uncle is a pharmacist. So, you know, I was familiar with it. And that year, there was an opening for pharmacy school. So I applied, I got in, and the rest is history. That part, I didn't go there to party. I really, really tried. So I put all my intellectual efforts into it and had a lot of success in it. So, and, you know,
well, I would hope you weren't there to party, considering that you're managing people's prescription and dispensing prescriptions. So I'm glad that you got through with that. So how long have you been in that profession?
I've been a pharmacist since 2006. So 17 years. And I've been with the company I've been at for this September would be 20 years. I worked through school. So I was a pharmacy technician while in pharmacy school, and then stayed with the same company, CVS, as a pharmacist. So I've been with the company a long time.
I want to say thank you for gifting us a copy which we at home call the scary book when it arrived. We had to turn it over so that we didn't frighten the son who's at home. But you did say that you have been in your career now for, you've been writing for 20 years. But what made you start?
When I was in school, in the beginning, like high school, when I was, you know, not a good student, reading was forced upon you. So reading, I did not like, you know, I didn't do it on my private time, but when it wasn't a requirement, I picked up, I think it was the first one I did for fun was Stephen King's The Shining. And ever since then, I fell in love with reading. So it began there. It began with being a fan of reading. And then one of my friends, his name is DK, and he was a writer. And I read one of his short stories, and I was blown away. It was a great story, and I was inspired. It wasn't the genre that I'm typically in. It was more like a Jack Kerouac type of story. I mean, On the Road is a great book, but that's not the style of writing that I was interested in. But I figured I'd give it a go. So I wrote a short story, and if I had it now, it'd probably be awful. I remember it's called 3 Days Rewound. I'm sure it would have been awful, but it was someplace to start. And I just kept on writing from there. And I just, primarily only short stories for a long time. And I didn't do anything with them. Most of them are lost. Some of them I reworked and put them in a collection of short stories. But, you know, I just did it as a hobby and it turned into a passion. And then from there, it turned into something I identify with, something of who I am.
Well, Chad, we have the same publisher. Tell me how you met Stacey, which will be interesting. But also tell me, what did you do with your manuscripts before then? Did you self-publish?
No, I haven't. It was, I knew the field was changing. So 20 years ago, you needed to find an agent to get you, like the gatekeepers, to get you into the publishing career. Self-publishing, you know, was around maybe, but it wasn't like a big thing like it is now. So it changed. Now, most books out in the market, I believe, are self-published. So it was on my mind that it might be a possibility, but I wanted to explore traditional publishing. You know, I had a completed manuscript. At that point, when I completed my first novel, I didn't even publish a short story yet. So I was completely green. So I didn't know where to start. So, you know, I crafted a query letter. I sent it out to a bunch of agents, I think 50 in total, not all at once, but I did like batches of three at a time. And I either got ghosted or got form rejection letters. And, you know, I was a little dismayed and thought, well, maybe self-publishing would be for me. But like I said, I had no idea where to start. I just want to go to Amazon and hit send. And because I knew it would be like a drop in the water. Miracles do happen, but usually if you just hit publish and do nothing, nothing's going to happen. So I joined lots of writing groups and was active on social media. And I came across Stacey on social media. I saw she made a comment on one of my feeds or one of my comments. And I saw that she was a publisher. So I checked out her homepage, and she said that she was open to submissions. I submitted the first couple chapters of my book, and she liked it. And we went from there. And like a dream come true. It was great.
Oh, absolutely. She's definitely been a champion in terms of getting our books out there. So tell me, how many books have you published already?
So at first, we had the completed manuscript, but Stacey wanted to get my name out there since, you know, it was brand new. So she asked if I had any short stories, and I had a bunch. I had 15 at least crafted, well-crafted short stories that I was proud of. So we compiled them into a book called The Void, and we released it first. It was kind of like a soft release. We didn't really blast it out there, but we just wanted to get my name out there. So that was first, The Void. It was last May, almost a year ago, or excuse me, a little bit more than a year ago. And then when I first gave my manuscript to Stacey, it was a book called A Paroxysm of Fear. It was one book. Stacey felt that it was too long. It was about like 120,000 words. So she thought it was too long, especially for a first novel. And she said even for the genre that was in, the horror, mystery, thriller genre, she felt that was too long. So she either suggested I cut it a lot or split it into two books. And we decided to split it into two books. So my first one, I renamed it The Prisoner of Fear. And then we followed it up with A Paroxysm of Fear. So I have those three, and then I have a series of three novellas that we released in March.
Oh, thank you for that. So the book that you sent to give away as a competition prize, The Prisoner of Fear, is actually book one. And could you repeat what the second book is called?
It's a tough title. It's called A Paroxysm of Fear.
Right,
So paroxysm
okay.
is like a spasm, or like you're almost like frozen in this, in a contraction of muscles, a spasm. So it's like you're frozen with fear.
What is it about horror that you like writing about?
I like that there's so many possibilities. You're not contained, you're not boxed in. So you could go the supernatural route. You could do psychological horror, and that's pretty much where I delve into. You could go the slasher type. You could go the slow burn. You could do gore. You could, there's so many possibilities. It's endless. So you could let your creative mind flow, and it's kind of like comedy. I like to invoke an emotion, whether it's fright with horror, laughter, sadness, despair. So I like to. You know, if the reader walks away and was just, grossed out, maybe that's not the best thing. But if the reader is, if I tapped into an emotion and they think about it for the next couple of days and they can't get that thought out of their head, that's my end goal. And I think horror leans into that, some types of horror, not all, because some, the Freddy Kruegers in this world, I mean, they're great stories and they have their place, but will it leave a lasting impression? For me, it doesn't. Stories like Seven, I don't know if you ever saw that movie. That stuck with me a while. Is it technically horror? Maybe, but that's the type of feeling that I like to evoke.
And Chad, tell me, how have your books been received?
Fairly well. I mean, you always get critics that like it or dislike it. It's a subjective field, so you have to be aware of that going in. But I submit my work to a lot of reviewers, and I always ask for an honest opinion. I never pay for reviews. I never want, a rubber stamp 5-star because it has no meaning to me. One, it's not, it doesn't give your reader a realistic view of your work. Plus, it doesn't help you as a writer. If someone says, "Yeah, it was great. I loved it," and same goes for the opposite. Sometimes I got like a 1 or 2-star review and it has like one word I didn't like it. Obviously, the reader didn't like it, but how does it help other readers, and how does it help me as a writer? But otherwise, it's been very, I think, well received. I took the criticisms to heart. Some of them, I look back on and like, oh yeah, I could have done this differently, or could have changed this in my writing style. I go back and look at it and take it to heart. Even though I am very confident in my writing and slightly egotistical, I'm not closed-minded. So I like to hear other people's opinion. And if it's well thought out and I could tell they, really put a lot of thought into their feelings of it, then I take it to heart and really take it seriously. But so far it's been well reviewed. Most 4 and 5 stars for the most part, a couple, 2 and 3. But for the most part, 4 and 5. People like at least the Prisoner in Fear and Paroxysm of Fear, that it's told from many different viewpoints. So you got a lot of different perspectives from the characters. And that was part of the fun of writing it. You get into the head of all the characters, and it was a challenge, but it was also fun as well.
I follow you on social media, so I've seen some of the reviews of your books. But how important is social media in helping you to promote your books?
I think, very important. As we mentioned, we share the same publisher, Hero Voice. But saying that, they're not a Random House, they're not a Penguin, they're not, one of the top three publishers. So they are, a smaller indie publisher. So, you have to promote yourself. So without that, and even if you're signed to the big three, I think I would do the same thing. I don't think it would change my approach, because you have to self-promote, and I want to connect to other writers. Like without that, I would never have met you. I also wanted to connect with the readers as well. So I try to, do a couple things on social media. One, to promote my work, but I don't overly do it, because you don't want to say, like, "Hey, I have a book, I have a book, I have a book." Tons of people have books, so that's not news to people. But big events like, cover drops or title drops or, release dates and things like that, or updates. And all my reviews, if I'll, post them as well, good and bad. But I also talk about my writing process, and where I am. So right now I'm currently writing a new book. So I'm very open with my followers and my friends on social media of where I am and what my approach is and the challenges and the wins and the losses that I am having. And also I post some things I like. Sometimes I play guitar, not well, but sometimes I'll post a video of me playing guitar. I post sometimes, I just went on a trip to Italy and Iceland. I documented that because it was part of my life, what it was doing. And, even though didn't directly affect my writing, it indirectly does. And also just like different books I'm reading, movies I watched, opinions on, connections I made between books and plays or authors and art and things like that. So just things I enjoy and love and have a passion for, I'll post. And I love to provoke engagement. So when I have like a thought or a question or an idea, I love interacting with people on social media.
I've been following you on social media for quite some time, and I have seen your followers increase on your author page. But just going back a bit, I was going to ask you, do you play guitar? Only because I can see two guitars behind you. How long have you been playing? Are you self-taught? Did you have lessons?
Well, it began, I always loved music. So as writing is a passion of mine, so is music. I love music. I love listening to music. I love talking about music just as much about literature and art and everything else. Everything art, I love. So I've been playing guitar. My uncle was a guitarist. He's a professional guitarist. If you ever seen the cartoon Thundercats, he played the guitar on the solo. And it's a little obscure, but he toured with Roberta Flack. And he's even been on, I think, one of Elton John's albums. So he influenced me a lot, heavily, on music. And 12 or 13, he gave me my first guitar. And I had lessons in the very beginning, but right now, more self-taught. The internet's very helpful. So YouTube's very helpful in picking up new songs. But as writing, I think, comes very natural to me. I think it's a natural talent. I really have to work with guitar. It's not natural. It's almost, I had to fight with it to get a song. And when I post, it sounds very raw, I guess is the right word, a kind word. But you would think that's like the first or second take. It takes me like 10 to 20 takes to get to where I am. So it doesn't come natural to me, but I do love it. So it's a hobby. It's nothing that I'm ever going to explore. I'm never going to go on stage and jam out. But, I'll play with it at home and for myself and for my family. But
there's no album coming then?
No. No. I don't know if I would listen to it. So no, if I won't listen to it, I won't subject other people to it. But yeah, I'll post on social media. If I'm playing a song, I think it's cool, I'll put it on there. So some people are like, oh, you need a little bit more practice. But and I do, but that's fine. That's fair.
Well, as long as you enjoy it, and that's the main thing, and it brings you pleasure from playing the guitar. The other question I had from you is that, again, through social media, I was aware that you traveled to Europe. Why Iceland and why Italy, and what's the connection? Because I'm sure you passed countries in between to get from Italy to Iceland.
Well, I didn't plan the trip. But here's the reason behind it. In Iceland, and I posted when we did it, there is a lake, a glacial lake. And it's the clearest, cleanest water almost on the planet. I don't know if it's number one, but it's one of the cleanest, clearest waters. And you could snorkel on it. And it's so clear, you could see straight to the bottom. And it's amazing. It's like you're flying because you're floating on top and you could see 50 feet down and it's immense. It's beautiful. So the reason we wanted to go to Iceland is my girlfriend, she's been there before, and you have to be 12 years old to go in the snorkel trip. And my girlfriend's daughter is 12. So once she turned 12, she wanted to go to Iceland. So we wanted a full week in Iceland. And my girlfriend has a friend in Italy that could show us around and give us some tours. So the second half of the trip, Italy was, since it's not terribly far, it's, a 5-hour flight. It was a good opportunity. And we also were in a wine tasting class. So it was great to, one of the three best wine countries in the world. So might as well. So I was all in. I was almost along for the ride. She planned everything. So I've never been on a trip like this before. I seem well-traveled, but I'm not. This is the first major trip I've ever taken. So it was really exciting for me and something I really plan to do in the future. I mean, I need to see England. I need to see France, Spain. I want to see it all.
If money was no object, Chad, where would you travel to?
Money was no object. Tough one. I like culture. So I would go all throughout Europe. Even though New Zealand is tempting, and I loved Iceland for that, is that the nature of it, it was majestic, and it was like you were on a different planet. But for me, culture and art is supreme. So I would want to go back to Europe, and I would definitely need to hit France. That's probably my dream. That's the number one goal for me, is to go to France and England. Those are the top two for me.
If you stop in the UK, if you stop in London in particular, then please look me up because I would love to show you and your family around Buckingham
Definitely.
Palace, Tower of London, and so on. And in terms of galleries, we have loads of art galleries here as well
Yes.
for you to explore. You know, so many you'd probably get lost, but I'll be glad to show you
Yeah.
around. So
Well, I heard
please make
the
sure
one
you
in
do
England
so.
is one of the four that you have to see to understand art. My girlfriend just, she's in Russia right now. She just sent me a video that she learned that there's four museums that you need to see. The one in London, the Louvre, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, and the Met in New York. And the Met's the only one I've been to. So yes, I need to see at least two of those four, or two of the four that are left for me to see at least.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I'd like to know where people would like to travel to, especially since we were in the pandemic for so long and in lockdown in some places,
Yeah.
and you couldn't really, there was such a restriction on travel. So a lot of people are now working towards making sure that they see more of the world as well and to get around a bit. So do you have any new projects coming out? Because I heard, and you can probably guess who told me, that you are thinking about publishing your own books in the
Yes.
future.
Yeah, I just wanted to, not that I'm a control freak, but with my work, I love having control. And I just wanted to see the other side. So I wanted to see what it was like to self-publish. I told, Stacey that I'm in no way leaving. I'm still a hero or a voice author, but I just wanted to see what the other side was like. So I'm planning on working on two projects simultaneously. So as I said, The Prisoner of Fear and The Paroxysm of Fear was written as one whole. So I wanted to go back to my roots and look into it, dive into that book, and try to make it into one. One of the major criticisms of the book, and it was one of my fears when splitting it, was that it ended too much on a cliffhanger. So the main mystery is not wrapped up in the first book. You need to read the second book for the whole mystery to be solved. You have pieces of the puzzles, and some things are answered in the first book. But some people like that, and some people didn't. And the major criticism, it was too abrupt of an ending. And it wasn't written as two books. So I kind of had to choose a point in the book where to split it in half. And then, I rewrote the ending, rewrote the beginning of the second book to try to smooth it out. But it wasn't written in that way, and it wasn't the intention. So I wanted to go back and edit it down. And going back, I think I posted this today on social media. I am wordy. I was really, really wordy. So I wanted to try to make my sentence structures concise, my plot concise, make it move along a little quicker. Because like I said, it's a psychological thriller. So a lot of the detectives in the book, they have a lot of dialogue and a lot of discourse on what the mystery is. So I try to make it more concise in this project. And then I'm writing a new work, a new novel, and that one's called The Confession. And it's very loosely based on the Lizzie Borden murders. And if you don't know who Lizzie Borden is, back in the late 19th century, she wasn't convicted. She was tried as an axe murderess. Her family, her mom or her stepmother and her dad were found brutally murdered with they call it an axe, but in reality it was a hatchet. And they're like, that face was obliterated. And at the time it was the crime of the century. It was like the OJ Simpson of that time, the case of that time. So it was huge. And I think it's a compelling, the characters, when reading the history of it, the people in it, I call them characters, but the people were so compelling. Their stories were so compelling. The story didn't really work out as a novel. So I totally made it my own. So I totally fictionalized it and used, borrowed some of history to make the novel. So I'm about halfway done that. I'm excited about that one. I just don't know how to what genre it falls in. I wouldn't call it horror, more maybe thriller, suspense. I don't know. I have to think about that one as complete.
Sure, Chad, congratulations on at least having a go. My very first book, I used a self-publishing service. So you pay them to do all of the editing, the formatting and so on, and you know, find your book cover and bring it all into fruition. And then obviously I got the offer from Stacey, so, and she wanted all three books, so she took the first one, and we had to remarkably make that second edition different from the first. And you know, there are challenges with trying to do that. So have you come across any challenges, and how have you been able to manage those?
The biggest challenge was giving enough time. If I did it right away, it wouldn't have worked. It's almost like you have to step away because you see the words as rote. My biggest challenge is flying through the dialogue because I know it by heart. I've read it, you know, 15 times. So I'm flying through the prose and the dialogue, and it's, you have to take time to slow down and read sentence by sentence because you miss a lot of the wordiness. I miss a lot of things. Wait, oh, I should have cut that whole sequence. I don't need. I'm being redundant. Yeah, maybe I'm driving home the point, but I'm boring the reader. I'm not moving the story along. But in your mind, you already read it 15 times, so you're just going through it. So it's like seeing. It's like a smell. You walk into a room and someone's cooking a delicious meal. You smell it right away. It hits you. It's new. But the more you're in the room, the more your senses get used to it. So it's almost like that. So you want to leave the room so you could get that smell again and you could critique it in a better way. And therefore, you could hone it, you could add some spice, you could take some things out and hopefully make it the best that it could be. The story in itself, the combination of books are, I mean, largely going to be the same, but hopefully the story reads a little bit differently. So hopefully it's a little bit more sleeker, less wordy, but the mystery, the intrigue, the psychological horror of it, hopefully that still stays. The trick is to make it concise, but you don't want to lose the descriptiveness of it. So you don't want to be vague and fly through things. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. So it's tricky to work out, but it's fun. And but the thing is, it can't just be me. So you have to find an editor. So once I'm done, I have to send it off and have it a fresh set of eyes on it because you're going to miss stuff on your end. One of the biggest mistakes I've read for self-published authors is they edit themselves and that's it. They don't have a second set of eyes on it. And it's essential. Going through this process, that's one of the number one things I've learned. You have to get another editor on it.
Yes. When I'm on social media and you see these questions that come up, like what advice would you give an aspiring, you know, author, I always say edit, 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 and edit again. And I agree with you, having a fresh pair of eyes look at your work and give you feedback on how the plot is developing. And also, you know, those little minor errors that your mind just does not see anymore because you've looked at the manuscript 100 times. So that's always useful. But tell me, what top tips would you give someone who wants to do what you're doing, who wants to publish a book?
Well, one is to write. Don't give up. If you have a dream, don't give up on it. Luckily, the people in my inner circle, the people around me, my family, my girlfriend, my kids, her kid, they've been immensely supportive. So I'm lucky in that. But not everyone has it. Some people have naysayers like, oh, you're crazy, or it's just a whim or a dream. Believe in yourself and just keep writing. But once you do write, once you have that story, it's never over. One, like you said, edit, 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 make it the most polished pearl that you could possibly do. But then that's half the journey. The second half of the journey is publishing. Even if you have a traditional publisher like I have, it's not time to sit back and sit on your hands. Yes, Stacey has been instrumental of getting me where I am today. I wouldn't be here without her, but I wouldn't be here without my effort as well. So develop a platform, have a social media presence, not on your personal page, have an author's page. Pick a couple platforms. Don't do them all. Don't be on every social media. You're gonna, one, the content won't be as engaging. Secondly, who has time? I mean, you need a, that's a full-time job. So pick two or three, or even one or two. I primarily Facebook and Instagram for me. Goodreads is another good outlet as well. So pick a couple and focus on that, and also have a author's website as well. So a landing page where, you know, someone looks up your name, they could find you. And then for me, a big marketing thing that I do is I search reviewers and bloggers and Instagrammers and influencers in the genre that I write. I follow them. I don't just like them. I follow them. I look at their work. I look what they do. And if they have a following, or if I like their content and I like what they're putting out, I'll reach out to them and see if they want to review my book. If they have a very big following, I will offer them a free physical book. It's a cost to me, but it's a, you know, a cost of advertising for me. But if they're just starting out, and I'll offer them an ebook or, you know, a PDF, and hopefully they review it on their Instagram. If I'm lucky enough, they'll put it on Goodreads and Amazon. Amazon reviews are huge for authors, all authors. If you are a reader, please leave reviews. But hopefully they'll leave reviews, and, you know, even if they don't, just any kind of, you know, word that it gets out there of who you are, what you do is a win. So those are the steps that I've taken. So hopefully it works out, and I'll never stop. That's the thing. It's my passion. So, you know, sometimes I have bad days that I'm like, oh man, you know, I haven't had as much sales today, or I had a really bad review, or someone on social media is beating me up. That happens a lot. For the most part, you know, like I said, I'm very confident in my work. I'm confident in my drive, and I'll never stop. So that's my advice. If you believe in yourself, don't stop.
That's fantastic advice, Chad. So thank you for sharing. And if I remember rightly, when I looked you up, did you have a couple of bestsellers in the rankings on Amazon?
A couple, and in the you know, in very specific fields. So like, I think in my novellas at one point it was like number, I don't think I cracked the top 10, but it was like number 12 in Western horror. It was the category. So in a couple of categories, yeah, I topped the top 100. But my favorite, I took a screenshot, I should print it, when releasing The Void, it cracked, I think, 50 of horror short stories. And mine was 51, I believe. And number 52 was Stephen King. That's like, oh my God. It was like, just seeing that, it was like, oh, the dream come true. So yeah, I took a screenshot of that, and I'll forever look at that whenever I have a down day. But right now, with Amazon, it goes up, it goes down. So it's a roller coaster. So right now, I'm mainly focusing on the projects that I'm working on and not what's on out there. So it has dropped a little bit of a sale here and there. That's to be expected. But each sale is big. And, you know, being in the top, you know, 100 in a category is nice. It's great. It's an ego boost for sure. But it's not the end all be all. The end all be all is to have a new reader, inspire someone, evoke an emotion in a reader, have someone follow you on social media and be interested in your work. So for me, that's the end goal. Because that's the last thing. It's, you know, I develop friendships. I mean, when I went to Iceland, I met with someone who follows me on social media. We had a beer together. That was amazing. I mean, it reached across the world. So it's mind blowing. So that's, to me, that's the biggest accolade that I could get.
I mean, that's wonderful. Imagine traveling all that way and meeting a fan. That's fantastic. I still think it's huge that you were next door to Stephen King on the Amazon rankings as well. Bearing in mind, he was one of the people that inspired you as a, you know, when you were reading his books in the first place. Yeah. And look how far he's traveled in terms of his journey. I wanted to ask you, what do you think is next? When you're dreaming dreams about your book career and their success, where would you like to see your books go next?
I mean, eventually, I mean, the dream among dreams is, you know, like I said, I'm a pharmacist, and it's been a fulfilling career, and, you know, pays the bills. But is it a passion of mine? No, it's not. Writing is a passion. So if that was to become my full-time job, that would be the dream come true. So the end goal is that. Saying that's going to happen overnight, I'm not unrealistic. It's not. I mean, I know how much I sell. For all my sales, I could go maybe a small trip or take my girlfriend out to a lavish dinner, but I can't pay rent with it. So I wanted it to be like a snowball effect. I don't expect to be an overnight sensation. I'm not going to be the next Stephen King with my next book. It's just, I mean, it's possible, maybe, but is it going to happen? No. So I just want to slowly build on what I have. Like you said, this time last year, last July, I think I had 200 followers on social media, and now it's 10 times that. So if I could keep that ball rolling, keep the momentum going, and keep on building on my base, you know, then eventually, hopefully I'll get there. So that's my goals, be realistic, but two, never give up on that end goal. Always have that end goal and find that pathway there. So that, I think my pathway there is that slow build, slowly build an audience with each new book. Hopefully I have a new reader, new followers, and then so on, so on, so on.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I follow people like Terry McMillan, and it was one of her last books that just propelled her and skyrocketed her into, you know, how Stella got her. I think the book is called How Stella Got Her Groove Back. And then people read that book, and then they went back and read all of her previous work. But do you see your books on screen at some stage?
I think so, because when I write, I visualize it. It's not just words on a page. I could see it. With the novellas, maybe. They're very obscure. I mean, they have a very niche genre. But with the Doyle and Brand series, the Prisoner and Paroxysm of Fear, I definitely could see on screen. One, that would be huge. I mean, that would be immense to see. I would be blown away. I would be humbled. But yeah, I could see it translating very well on screen. So, you know, here's hoping.
You have two main protagonists in those books. Who would play them? Who in Hollywood do you think could take on those two characters?
That's a great question. And let me on the spot. Years ago, I would think Johnny Depp would play the more pretentious and the more uptight of the characters. That's Thomas Bram. But now I think he would make a good John Doyle. John Doyle, he, you know, is a little plump. He is very much into his own head. His main fears drive his motivation to defining the occult, to proving that, you know, monsters are real, even though he's the biggest skeptic. So I think he would make a really good John Doyle now. Maybe when he's younger, Thomas Bram. But Thomas Bram, oddly enough, at first when I saw the actor in Twilight, I discarded him and I thought he was, you know, Twilight's not my thing. I know it's a huge following and huge fan base, but for me, it wasn't my thing. But this actor has really, I think, developed, and I really like his work now. So I think Robert Pattinson would make a great Thomas Bram. His work in The Lighthouse, actually part of that movie, inspired the novellas that I came up with. So he inspired some of my work. But I think he would make a good Thomas Bram. So I could say it. So let's make it happen.
That's a fantastic answer. The cover, who helped you design that? And where did the idea come from?
That was mainly Stacy. I would say pretty much all Stacy. I mean, we had a few different covers. And at first, we had ours. We thought it was locked in. We were set on it. But then it was, I don't know, a little too noir, a little too subdued, I would say. It was more like a classic, like girl screaming with the sheets over her face. But this one was inspired by one of the characters. Her name's Cordelia. And that's the main mystery of the case. That's where John Doyle and Thomas Bram tried to find out the mystery. She turns into an abomination. So that's basically a frontal view of what they see when they reveal of the abomination. Most people love the cover. To me, it was striking. You know, if it's on a bookshelf, you could see it across the room. It invokes an emotion, good or bad. I mean, it invokes some kind of emotion. Like you said, a lot of people have to turn their face down if they have kids because it scares them. The one critique that it's too much, too harsh, too brash. And also the book, it is considered horror. But it's not like that thrill, that, you know, that gore horror. There's not a ton of monsters in it. So some people thought the cover was too much for the material inside. since it's more of a psychological horror, and that provokes, like, you know, a monster almost. So that's the critique. So I took the good with the bad, but for the most part, people loved it. You know, when I get a review on Instagram and the reviewer posts it, you see all the comments. One of the things, awesome cover, awesome cover, awesome cover. You always see that. So I think Stacey knocked it out of the park. I loved it. When she brought it back to me, it was about a month before publication. We had the other cover for months and months, and that was what we're going to go with. But she came up with that one, and I loved it. I thought it was jarring, so striking. So that part of it I liked.
Well, it's wonderful to have a publisher that's on the same page as you and gets you. And even as late as it being 4 weeks before publication, you know, is totally behind you and open into looking at another cover, or, you know, another aspect of it, because you above everything else have to be happy with what's been produced. And the book cover is certainly striking. I would give you that. It's certainly striking. Is it something that, would you have a new cover for the full length book?
Yeah, I have a new cover. Well, I don't have it yet. I am looking at different cover artists because I'm all into art. So I wanted to hire someone to have a custom design. The one that I picked, he's on a break. So hopefully he'll be back before publication. Hopefully, I'm hoping to publish it in October. So hopefully by September, we'll get to the brass. But I have a definite cover in mind. The title is going to be different as well, because I don't want to... The Prisoner of Fear, even though Paroxysm of Fear was the original title, The Prisoner of Fear works so well. But I don't want to take away from these books, because these books are out there. A lot of hard work went into publishing it, and I don't want to take away from that. So it's going to make it a little bit of its own thing. So the title will be different, and I'll have a new cover as well. So yes, I do have a cover in mind. The title, that was tough. Me and my girlfriend, she came up with one of the instrumental words. I was stuck on the word, and she came up with them like, fit perfectly. So I had the title. I haven't dropped it yet, but I could drop it on your show. I don't mind. It's going to be called The Prisoner, which I love the word prisoner, of despair.
I mean, that fits both books together, doesn't it? A little bit from the first book and a little bit from the second book.
Right.
So that's perfect. Yeah. Do you have the book nearby? Do you have a copy of your book nearby? I just wanted to know whether you're up for reading a little bit from the book, please.
I do. Yeah, I've actually read it. And I just want to say, speaking of cover design, the second book, here's the second book, the follow-up. That cover design was custom. That was made by, actually, you see, I have tattoos, by my tattoo artist. And we were discussing, while getting a tattoo, I was discussing my journey. I love his work, obviously, it's on my body. And I had something very, very specific in mind, and knew we could pull it off. So that's where that cover came from. So, but yeah, I have the book in front of me. Where would you like me to start?
Yeah, you've got a letter here, a letter to John Doyle from Dr. Charles Fulton on page 30. I'd like to read some of that.
Of course. Okay. Letter to John Doyle from Dr. Charles Thornton. Dearest John, it's been some time since I've written. My work has taken all of my energy and thoughts, as I'm sure that your duties require the same amount of dedication. Time is a virtue that we insufficiently possess. I hope this letter finds you in good health, but I fear if your eyes are scanning these words, then you've fallen into the trap of deep malaise. I know you all too well, my friend. Swing your legs off your bed, pour yourself a strong cup of black coffee, and stay away from the bourbon. Doctor's orders. I am about to embark on a journey back home. My departure is from Amiens, France. A strange case of a little boy, the age of 9, called me to this beautiful land. Amongst a field of lilac is housed the scene of anguish and disparity. I was in Paris at a neurologic conference when word traveled to my ears. When I heard the story of young Luke, I left. The family was in contact with a priest before my arrival. I was fortunate that I traveled fast. If the cleric were to intercede and offer an archaic treatment, it would have made matters much worse for Luke. He has suffered so much. It would be a travesty for Luke's condition to deteriorate at the hands of the so-called expert. These cases are never a religious matter, but often it is a trusted solution. I don't blame the family. I could sympathize with their desperation and can understand that they would misconceive Luke's symptoms as anything but having a medical cause. At first, the family was skeptical of my ability to help their son. After a heated conversation, we agreed I could observe Luke and his condition. I believe they came to his decision in order to convince me that Luke was indeed possessed. It was my duty to convince them otherwise. But at the moment, I kept my opinions to myself so they could get my foot through the door. I must admit that his symptoms were severe. My heart bled for the poor boy. It was such a sin to see innocent creatures suffer. When I first entered his room, I noticed the frailty of his body. His skin hugged his bones, and his clothes seemed three sizes too big. Luke seemed very agitated. He clenched his teeth, often grinding them in a circular motion. Luke was standing in the corner of his bedroom, facing the door. He scratched his arm raw and then abruptly stopped. Luke never looked up. The boy pulled down his pants and urinated right in front of me. I had been a practitioner for quite some time, and I'm rarely shocked. The boy horrified me as he knelt down on the floor and then lapped up his urine. I never got the feeling that he committed this grave act for my sake. I don't believe he recognized that I was even present. Luke rarely spoke in an understandable language. My French is commendable, but not perfect. Even a novice speaker would know that he's babbling incoherently. Sometimes Luke spoke with grunts, and other times he barked like a rabid dog. He had a fascination with spiders. He would try to capture them and keep them in his captivity, only to stare at their arachnid movements. The most notable thing I witnessed was a grand mal seizure that lasted about 10 minutes. Having seen cases similar to this, I was confident, but Luke's was the most severe. I believe that Luke had suffered through several clusters of severe grand mal seizures, which led to a psychiatric break. I offered this conclusion to his parents, but they were resistant to my diagnosis. Offering my case log to his parents, I presented many examples of comparable cases. After an impassioned argument, I convinced them to delay their appointment with the priest until I could begin treatment. I was honest with them. Luke would never fully recover. The seizures have done their damage. They could make a tincture that would lessen the frequency and severity of the seizures, and this would give his brain time to recover. With some luck, he may regain some of his mental faculties. I was relieved when they concurred with my treatment plan. If they allowed a priest to perform an exorcism, it would have aggravated his condition. No benefit has arisen from this barbaric practice, and I feared the ritual would be detrimental. I was gathering ingredients for his tincture when I received a letter that altered my course. I had no clue how Mrs. Bethel found me. A few individuals had knowledge that I traveled to Paris. Not one soul was aware I was sidetracked and took up a case in Amiens. The appearance of the note shook me, but I was disturbed even more so when I opened the letter and read its contents. Miss Charlotte Bethel had written this note, and her words carried great urgency. I knew Miss Bethel very well. As a child, I was often at her residence as a playmate of a daughter, Cordelia. Cordelia was one of my closest friends. We grew up together and continued to be very close friends until adulthood. I never told you, John, that I almost never left Ashford. I wasn't obligated to my local general practice, as more interesting endeavors called me away. It was Cordelia. I knew I cared for her more than a mere friend. I couldn't guarantee that she felt the same way about me. Oh, if I could only understand the heart and mind of the opposite sex as I do medicine. I could not articulate what has driven me away from home. Was it my cowardice? Was I too fearful to face the possibility that Cordelia wouldn't reciprocate my love? Or was it my intellectual boredom, the reason I pursued a fascinating line of work that led me to remote places? After reading Mrs. Bethel's alarming tale, I fear I may never know. Mrs. Bethel did not correspond with me socially, but she was seeking my help. The news of my poor Cordelia is too painful to bear. She's fallen ill, and any medical care that has been applied has fallen short. Her symptoms seem troubling. Forgive me, my good friend, but at this moment, I could not dive into greater detail. I had to steady my hands to write these last few lines. I can be the objective practitioner with the elderly patient with severe cardiomegaly or an infant with croup, but not with my Cordelia. On my voyage home, I will rewrite Mrs. Bethel's letter in full and send it to you directly as soon as I hit land. I will first examine Cordelia, but I have a gut feeling that I may need a more specialized opinion. If I call for your help, I pray that you may be available. My only reservation is leaving poor Luke behind. I was fortunate enough to gather the ingredients and prepare the tincture. Hopefully the results of the medication will convince his parents and thus stave off the priest until my return. So with a heavy heart to admit that Luke may have to be a sacrifice to my Cordelia's reviving health. May God forgive me, Charles.
Oh, wow. Wow, Chad. It really does make you want to know what happens next. And classic page turner, as they say. So thank you for reading your book. In fact, thank you, full stop, for coming on the Author to Author podcast.
Absolutely.
If people want to find you on social media, how do they do that?
Just look up Chad Miller Author. And that's also my homepage as well, my website. It's chadmiller-author.com. Yeah, I'm very heavy on Facebook. I have, like I said, a website and also on Instagram. And also you could go to hearourvoice, LLC.com and find my links to there and other authors like yourself as well.
Thank you very much. And can people get hold of the book directly from you?
Not directly. I don't sell directly off my website. I believe they could get it directly through the publisher, through Hero Voice. But mostly it's sold on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and I believe Walmart.com as well.
So many more. It's on Books A Million, Target. .com. So yeah, quite a few, you know, shopping and supermarkets and so on as well. So they will find your book online there as well, which is fantastic. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. And I wish you all the best with your future projects, especially the new books that you have coming out soon.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been an honor. I mean, I've been following you as well. So it's been an honor to talk to you, and I find inspiration from you as well.
It is competition time now. Where in the USA is Chad based? If you know the correct answer, please contact me on Instagram at lovingtheauthor by this Friday for your chance to win a copy of his scary book, Prisoner of Fear. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.